It's Alzi.
Yes, sir.
Thanks for coming out from the HBC in Belleville via DHL Stadium in Cape Town, via Bloberg, through the traffic to talk analytics, statistics, data. I need you to educate me, to educate all our loyal fans, because they've said we want more analysis from Zalzo.
Who has said this?
I did. Okay. So I've created a piece, thanks to the URC's website, called Stats. And the headline on kyo.co.za, and it's not like I like to say my name, it's what the URL is called.
Who named that website?
Yeah, I guess it was me. Bulls finish, Stormers create, and Glasgow lead. And after 13 rounds, that is the state of play. Bear in mind, the Bulls are in the top eight just.
Why do you say it like that?
Because they just made it the top. They just broken the top eight. My God, where have you been for
13
rounds?
No, I'm just trying to understand your thinking there, mate.
I know that you've been at the HBC head down in the crunchy numbers, but the Bulls have played as well. And you actually beat them. We were there.
No way.
Glasgow Warriors, top of the table, 50 points, 13 matches, 10 wins, more bonus points than the Stormers. Second, people forget, Stormers are second, 10 from 13, 46 points. Their best ever start in the history of the tournament. But people think there's something wrong in Cape Town. But the stats are very, very different. So if you do go onto the blog, you will see a breakdown of that and a link back to the like every stat that there is for player and for teams after 13 rounds of the United Rugby Championship. But I'm just going to run through a few, Zels, and then I just want you to have the floor, mate.
Have it.
Because a podcast is about two people speaking. Okay.
I love it. Yes.
And, you know, I can't have a cardboard cutout anymore.
Oh, my goodness.
So, in a nutshell, and when I phoned you and I said, listen, I've got these stats telling me, he said, I ignore them. No, I can't. So, just contextualize for me, taking the two league leaders, and their stats are very different in terms of how they've got to their 46 and 50 points. And what does one read into it if you're a lay supporter and not necessarily, like you switch on the telly on a Saturday, you watch, you read a couple of articles, you're not, your job doesn't allow for you to be crunching numbers, doing data, becoming an expert via artificial intelligence. what is the summary of a Glasgow season and then the Stormers? After 13 rounds, there are no state secrets in terms of how they've been playing and kind of where their impact is or vulnerabilities and kind of the variances.
Yeah. So I think what you have to remember around stats is probably like the perception about rugby, especially amongst fans and in the schoolboy scene, is it's the object of the game is to score tries. And I think scoring tries is important because you get 5 points for it and potentially seven. So obviously that is important. But I wouldn't say scoring tries is the objective in rugby, and especially in the pro level. So what's interesting to me is if you look at the log, you've got Glasgow Warriors are one, Stormers are two. And if you look at the points four column, those two teams are there and thereabout in terms of points scored, right? They're top five teams for points scored. And if you look at the points difference, points scored and points conceded, they are one and two, right? But the takeaway there is not that they've scored more, or they have scored more points than their opponents, but the takeaway there is not the attack, it's the defense. Those teams are number one and two in the comp for defense. So stopping your opponents from scoring tries, if you were a business person who knew nothing about rugby and all you got when you bought a franchise was this table, the thing to take away from it is that defense is prescriptive in terms of whether you win or lose. Your ability to limit your opponent's scoring, their output in that metric, determines whether you're successful or not successful. So you also have to be able to score points yourself. But if you look at the points four column, there are teams like the Lions, for example, who've scored the most points in the URC and they're in seventh place. And if you look at a team like the Bulls, they're up there, also top five. They're in eighth place for points scored. And the Lions are plus 20 in points difference, so their defense hasn't come to the party. And the Bulls are plus 50 in points difference. Their defense at times this season hasn't come to the party. So the key to the success is not in the points output, it's in limiting the points input.
How hard is that for teams to manage in this modern new age game where everyone's trying to take the scrum away. Everyone's trying to take the line out away.
Yeah.
Everyone's basically wants to turn it into six touch, especially in Australia and to a degree in New Zealand. You know, Quade Cooper coming out and saying, you've got to play quickly. You've got to give that person a chance to play and speed up the game. Why do we need the game to be sped up when it's been great for over 100 years in terms of the mini contests and the battles? And that there's not an acknowledgement of the power and the impact and the influence of defense, which is an incredible skill, and then leads to transition. So a team that can defend well and transition well is probably the most complete team if they've got a good set piece and a goal kicker in rugby.
Yeah.
So it's defense and transitions. Because the Bulls have scored 54 tries, the most, but the defense was awful in the beginning of the season. For one, they scored, they leaked one.
Mm.
How do coaches not buy into this narrative generally of we've got to score a lot of tries and potentially lose 40-36, then win 23-17 in a very good game of rugby, and then appease the owners and the marketers who say, well, who's going to come watch this?
Well, yeah, that's why I think you can be very successful in rugby as a money ball guy, because the game, there's a large chunk of the game that lives in a fantasy world about what is the way to play to be successful. And there's a critical mass of people who run rugby, I think, are out of touch with what the game actually is, or they know what the game actually is and they're resented for that and they're trying to change it. But to me, it's hilarious that after 30 years of trying to tweak the game to be basketball, if you give me a top five defense and a top five scrum, we'll be more successful than most of the teams in the league. And those are the foundations of success. So I think oftentimes coaches find themselves in a situation where a chunk of the players that are at their disposal come from schools where it's that ideology around rugby is ingrained in their psyche. So it's quite tricky to break that.
Well, if you go back, and the ultimate test of anything is to win the Rugby World Cup final. It's bigger than a club final. It's bigger than a Rugby Championship Six Nations finale. And 80% of Rugby World Cup finals were won on defense. Defense and a kicker. So no matter how successful a team has been, how many tries they've scored in the 4 years between World Cup cycles, when it comes to a final, the box 12-11, four penalties, defense heroically. Even the big win against England in the final in 2019 was born out of heroic defense that 5 minute period before halftime, the 5 minutes after halftime, and when they basically went two scores ahead with kicks from Andre Pollard, those two magical tries from Mapimpi and Cheslin Kolbe. It's invariably won off the boot, the biggest games, and it's invariably won when you look at the tackle stats and the kind of dominant tackles. How do you kind of, as a data specialist, a trend specialist, get that message across that it's not a crime to kick and it's not a crime to tackle, and from that, transition tries come and tries will come. Mm. So there's been the Bulls have scored the most tries. Stormers are in eighth place, but the differential is a 1-5 pointer, if that, over a balance of period. Where is the state of the game where, you know, we saw that Bulls game 13-8, you know, it was a ripper, it was a thriller.
Yeah.
People were enthralled by it. 78th minute try to win it. Isn't that the essence of rugby? And this wanting to just turn everything to barbarians type Harlem Globetrotters carnival, 38-36s, isn't where the game should be.
Yeah, so I think rugby has just forgotten where it came from. I think that's the underlying issue. And I think until you address that, you're always going to be fighting against this narrative. Because back in the day, when rugby first arrived in South Africa, I assume, they didn't sell tickets to games. And I don't think people came to see sidesteps. There wasn't like a marketing campaign about how guys can make you miss and there's offloads. People were invested in a team being successful against another team. It was one village versus the other village. That's how all these ancient sports started. I can't remember the name of it, but that Italian sport where there's a ball and this village tries to move the ball from one place to the opposition village or whatever it is. They try and get the ball and take it back to their village. I can't remember how it works. But it's that primal, and that's where sport comes from. Nobody decided that we're going to build arenas and create a game out of thin air and entice people to come there because the beers will be cheap. people wanted to see the contest because there was relevance in the result. My village beat your village. That was the point of it. And so I think rugby has gone on a large detour over the years to try and bring in fans who are not rugby people, people who may be drawn by the spectacle of it, the fireworks, the music in the stadium, I don't know. And those fans commercially are important, but they're not at the heart of it, because what will happen is at some point in the future, somebody will do something amazing and those fans who are not rugby people will be drawn away to that other event and they'll go and watch that instead. Where real rugby people who are invested in the Springboks beating England, they don't care whether it's 3-0 or 53-0, they're going to pitch up at the game season in and season out. And those are the people you've got to appeal to. So winning is the basis of sustained success in every pro sport. Without winning, you don't have sustained success. Doesn't mean there aren't examples in recent history of teams that are semi-contenders and through marketing have great commercial value, but I don't think that's a sustained model for success.
If you look at, I think last year when we were at Pazula and you did a talk and some guys off the floor were talking about schoolboy rugby, Curry Cup, and why can't the box play like that? And I mean, you were quite, I think you crushed a bit of romance there that evening in telling them what schoolboy rugby was. I mean, do you want to just kind of revisit that?
Yeah, so I think schoolboy rugby is amateur. And so you can't compare it to professional rugby. It's not the same thing. You're dealing with kids, and you're dealing with a great variance in ability between the worst and best player on the field that is not replicated at the pro level. And the whole point of schoolboy sports is to participate and to compete and to try and win. But the bottom line is not winning at the amateur level. There are secondary and tertiary objectives that are close. At the pro level, the bottom line is, did you win or did you lose? It's not about participating. And I think pro rugby has a really hard time dealing with that sort of assertion. So it is very different at those levels. Where at high school, if you're the biggest bloke, you get game line every time you carry the ball. The next level up, there's a bloke called Levi Douglas or Andre Smith who's going to tackle you backwards every time you touch it. It's a whole different game, and it becomes more technical because of that. So it is tricky to compare those two things. I did a little research project on the various pro leagues in the world, and we looked at kick volume by month. And so when the sports, when the leagues kick off, it's autumn, and the kick volume is relatively low. And then you get to the winter parts of the season and the kick volume goes up, and then you get to the sort of end of winter, we're moving into spring now in the north, and then the kick volume goes down. And then as you hit the playoffs, the kick volume goes through the roof again. Now, that playoff period is close to summer. And the only reason the kick volume goes up is because those teams have decided that winning is the only objective. You have to win or you go home. Now, the point that I'm trying to make is, if everybody knows that kick volume is related to winning, why wouldn't you do that every single week in and week? Why do you have to have this circular conversation about should we carry the ball, should we kick the ball? If you're there to win as a professional, which is your job, surely that's what you have to do.
So I go back to the late Basil Bay, iconic at Bishops, just renowned for Bishops played with no numbers on the back, and they basically ran that ball from everywhere. The pole schools would know that. So if they had a good pack, a good defense, they could beat Bishops, because they knew there was not going to be much kicking. They weren't going to take kicks for poles, so you could also just kind of infringe as much as you wanted. But people loved watching Bishops play back in the day, especially the Herschel Gibbs type era, okay? One of the great schoolboy fly-offs. Basil Bay then was, the call was, why doesn't Basil Bay coach professionally? And eventually he said, okay, I'm in. And he went to Northern Free State, the Griffins. And it was a disaster. He went there with limited players and he lost games by more than 100 points in the Curry Cup, trying to play the Bishops way there. And I think that was, for me, the most noticeable thing of the philosophy at schoolboy level, which is about skills, developing skills, because you can't teach that once the guy gets into professional rugby. It's so different to what you experience in professional leagues. And then it brings me back to the Stormers this season. You've been a huge exponent throughout when you were a journalist, when you're running SA Rugby Magazine as the editor on this show. It's not that you anti-tries, it's like you just pro-logic in terms of what you just said. And there's been a huge shift in the Stormers overbalance this season in their approach. They're second on most kicks and very good in what they've retained as well. And it's the best season they've ever had in the URC. 10 from 13. Where 10 from 18 normally gets you into the playoffs in the URC. People don't realize that they haven't necessarily been sexy, but they've been successful. Why are people so opposed to that?
It boggles my brain as well. I think a lot of the criticism comes from the weekend warrior fan, you know, is there for do the roar, do something amazing, do a somersault, entertain me.
Thank you, Daddy.
Yeah, exactly. I think there's a lot of that. So I think the casual fan is just like, show me some highlights that impress me, right? I think for the diehard fan, and you know you're a diehard fan whether in a game against the Bulls, if you're happy with victory by any means, you're a diehard fan. If you need the Stormers to excite you and potentially lose, and you'll be happy with that against the Bulls, and maybe you're not a diehard fan. But I think when it comes to the kicking game, I don't want to kick the ball. You know, it's not that I'm not Mornay Stain. I'm not this fantastic kicker of the ball, and I've always thought that that's the. I just know by looking at the numbers that that helps in terms of your ability to succeed. Now, having said that, Glasgow Warriors are top of the log, and they've kicked the second least in the competition. And that is very, very rare. But Glasgow Warriors may be second least in kick volume, but in other kick metrics, they are exceedingly good as well. So what Glasgow do really well is they understand the chronology of the game in the sense that you have to do, it's like a book. You have to have chapter one, then chapter two, then chapter three. You can't start at the end of the book. You know, it's like a love story. Let's take Titanic. If that movie started with Leo slipping off the door and falling under the water and drowning, I don't think it would have been a tearjerker. But the reason that everybody was invested in that moment at the end of the movie is because of what came before. You got to know who Leo was in the movie, who Kate was in the movie. There was a connection to those people, right? So you have to build that connection. The same thing in rugby. You have to start with your fundamentals. You have to have a scrum and a line out. You have to have defense. There are other pieces to this puzzle, but if you get those things right, your attack will flourish. If you start, we are going to attack first, really attack-minded, and then try and add in those fundamentals later, it can go horribly wrong and blow up in your face. So I think what Glasgow does exceptionally well is defend. And the Stormers do that as well, second in the comp for that. So in terms of the quality of their defense, those two teams are right up there. And when you defend well, you create opportunities to score from transition. And when you attack from transition, you're attacking against teams whose defense is not prepped to stop you to the same level as if you try and knock the front door down. So I think there's an order to success in rugby.
I never knew you were such a big fan of Titanic and Jamie Cameron and
mate.
Can you do the
what is it? I'm flying. What did she say?
I don't know.
I don't remember, mate. But James Cameron, mate.
Mate,
great
you seem
movie.
To
aliens.
Remember the you seem to remember
aliens,
the chapters,
mate. Some great movies.
You seem to remember the chapters, huh?
Yeah.
Oh, I love that. That's like a soft side to you. You know, this hardened, no tries, all kick kind of guy.
I just want to win.
So did Leo, and you see where he ended.
That is true, mate. But he had a great fringe. He went down with a great fringe.
Hanging on to an iceberg, wasn't it? Or something like that.
He wasn't hanging on to an iceberg.
Well,
the iceberg was the villain.
He felt like he was hanging on to an iceberg.
If he hung on to the iceberg, he'd still be alive.
Looking at, and I just want you to unpack this a little bit, and then kind of just give me an explanation. So we go on points, we go on defense and that. This is a relevant stat. Entries into the opposition 22. And the Stormers are ranked second after 13 rounds, 150. Yet their try conversion is eighth in the tournament. Is there a direct correlation to that? Or is that just a matter? Because we know a lot of the Stormers' tries do come from transitions or from a counterattack. Or what do you read into that? And forget that it's the Stormers.
Mm.
So I don't want to kind of put you in a spot or feel that you kind of... no one's going to talk to you when you get back to the HBC.
Yeah.
So say it's any team that has got the second most, 150, but the eighth on the try scoring. What would you as just attribute that as a data specialist?
So I think obviously if you can convert every time you enter the 22, you're going to be a very, very difficult team to beat because every opportunity you get, you convert it into points. But I will say a team like Glasgow are first for entries into the 22 and they rank seventh for points per entry. So how many your conversion rate there is relevant. I'm not saying it's not relevant, but it can be skewed by other factors. So for example, if you're a team like the Lions, who rank first for points per entry. When you get penalties in that zone, you kick them. So there's your 3 points. So on average, you're converting an entry penalty into 3 points. And Chris Smith is obviously key to that. Whereas if you're a team that spurns kickable opportunities in that area and chases more tries, your conversion rate's going to go down. Your percentage of conversions is going to go down. But that doesn't mean you're not successful, because perhaps you go for those line-out tries, you don't convert them, but you apply pressure on the other team, they get a yellow card. And so you're playing the game against fewer players and you're scoring from other parts of the field. Maybe your long-range tries goes up, etc. So there are a lot of moving parts to it. The bottom line is you want to be number one for entries and number one for conversions. So there isn't a team in the computer, no, we don't want to do that. But decisions you make in other facets of the game are going to influence what your numbers, what your outputs are in those departments. So I think, like I say, Glasgow are seventh for points per entry, even though they have the most entries, and then the Lions are first for points per entry, and I think they're sixth for volume of entries. So without using the word balance, you're trying to be as effective as you can there.
As a data specialist, we had this chat a couple of days ago, and I was asking you just kind of break down the role in terms of analyst and data and videos and exactly how much footage do you have to watch. And you said, no, you are following trends, you're following data. And that's the kind of the role that maybe has been lacking generally in rugby, in professional rugby, is no one's following those trends and data and basically giving it to the other specialists in the areas to look at and then kind of apply it relevant to the player personnel you've got or kind of where you are positioned in your season. If you can just kind of expand a little bit on that.
Yeah, so I think when it comes to data, there's a tactical level and there's a strategic level, right? So tactically, I think all coaches operate on a tactical level ever since the advent of video review, right? So if you review an opposing team, what are you going to do? You're playing Portsmouth United next week. So you get video footage of them and you say, okay, well, let's see, how do they attack? Attack from where? Let's look at their scrum attack. How do they attack from scrum? Where do they go? Do they go wide? Do they keep it close? Do they go same side? What is their attack style? You might look at the same thing from line-out attack. And do they counterattack? Don't they counterattack? So those are all tactical things. And you might say, oh, this team, they've got a monster number 12. They go forward of him. Once they've got momentum, it's same side carries. They just keep beating you to a pulp. And once they've got in behind you, then it's game on and they're deadly. So we have to stop that 12. That's a tactical... it's a tactical point of interest, and you've created a tactical solution for that. And that is fundamental to being successful in rugby, is being able to solve the very practical challenges and take advantage of the practical opportunities that video footage reveals to you. But if you only look at that, you can miss other things which are massively important. And rugby is very slowly coming around to understanding the data side of it, which I think American sports have been high on for a very long time. So, for example, if you're playing a team that after 10, 15 games has not won a game where they make less than 100 carries or less than 100 passes, there is an insight in there that you need to apply to your tactics that is going to help you be more successful. So if you're going to feed that team more than 100 carries and more than 100 passes, that team's statistical chance of success goes up. Now, those numbers are not going to perform for you on the field, but it should inform your tactical thinking around how you're going to take that team on, where before you may have thought, well, let's kick to these guys and defend. You may decide, well, let's hold on to the ball and make them tackle, because it'll keep their carry count down. And in those game situations, they are less successful.
If you look at the Stormers last season and you look at them this season, anyone who's followed them fairly closely, what would be, if there's anything distinctly different to the approach, what would it be?
Yeah, so I mean, I wasn't involved with them last season. I was watching from the outside. I would say the Stormers have a very good handle on what their game model is great. You know, in terms of maximizing the opportunity for success, I think they are right over the target. I think fundamental to the Stormers is set piece efficiency, obviously solid defense, the ability to be very dangerous from transition. Any opportunity for the guys to play rugby, they are deadly. And then keeping the penalty counts, I suppose, is obviously a key ingredient to that. So I wouldn't say that something fundamentally has changed. I think it's a work in progress. And as we saw at the end of last season, that run of success kind of overlapped into this season with another long run of success. So teams are obviously always trying to find ways to stop you, and they're asking different questions. And when they ask you different questions, you've got to learn what are the answers to those. And I think that's the position the Stormers are in now.
What you're seeing with the Bulls as the evolution of the season, Ike has kind of taken over the forwards, new assistants coming in, Neil DeBrain coming from Paul Boys High,
yep.
He is director of rugby. Briefly, what you've seen in them?
Defensively, they've improved massively. And like I talked about chapter 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, when your defense improves, that's chapter 1, your defense improves, you get opportunities to score from that improved defense. So where before you were making 4 tackles, missing 5 tackles, conceding a try, and then having to restart, now you're in a position where you're making 3 or 4 tackles, you're winning a turnover, or you're winning a penalty, or you're putting them in a position where they kick not on their own terms, and now your attack is getting the ball in a position that is favorable, where your chances of scoring a try are much better than they were before.
Okay, Lions?
Love the Lions. Clever team, punch above their weight, some really good fundamentals, very interesting carrot that they dangle in terms of getting you to play fast, and how you respond to that really brings them into the game or takes them out of the game. But they're a team that has grown immensely. They're a quality side.
And then the Sharks. Plum was there. JP Peterson's there. Is there a noticeable difference in approach in terms of coaching philosophies? We know player personnel, it's changed. He's invested in Jansen. He's made Andre the Giant at 12 captain, gave him additional responsibility. But when you look at the Sharks from early season to now, anything that's really changed, or is more mindset that's changed?
Yeah, so looking from the outside in, I mean, JP was there when we won the Tri Nations in 2009 and were so effective with the Springboks. He understands the kicking game, the contestable kicking game, and isolating players in the kicking game. And I think what the Sharks appear to have done is they've become a lot more structured around how they want to play and where they want to play, and they are committed to that. So when they put boot to ball and then back their physicality, I think they are a very difficult team to stop because they can get a roll on. And you still, when you pepper that with the X factor of the guys that they've got there, most recently Guillaume, who's coming on at fullback, you've got guys who can make you miss in space. They put you under pressure, they punch you in the nose, and then when you try and get out of that situation, you give them the ball, the guys catching the ball can move and can hurt you, and that's what they've been doing.
All right. Based on that, all 4 at home again this weekend. We got 4 from 4 last week. We asked for it. They delivered. The Stormers kind of delivered in probably the messiest way in a match that most thought would be the most comfortable, but they got the 5 league points. 25 tries to 7 in totality. We do understand that those Northern Hemisphere sides that came over, of them were undermanned because they had rested the Six Nations players from the current Six Nations.
Yeah.
There's a few that have been drip-fed into the second round. And again, they only play 2 games and they go home. But like the old Super Rugby, they're not here for 4 weeks. It'd be a very different thing if they want to for 4 weeks. Do you see a 4 from 4 again this weekend? And that South Africa has to make this kind of count before we go into the Investec Champions Cup playoffs in the next fortnight? Or is there a surprise coming somewhere?
Mate, I hope I am very wrong on this, but I've got a feeling that there is one turn in the punch bowl this weekend. I'm going to go from the back. So from the Saturday night game, I've got the Stormers to win by 7. I've got the Lions to beat the Dragons by 20. I've got Munster to lose to the Bulls by 8. And I've got Cardiff to ambush the Sharks at Kings Park, mate, on Friday night. They've played them twice there and they've won both of those games. So I've got Cardiff to sneak it by 4 points.
Okay, you're very conservative though in your points differentials, and I like that because I'm the complete opposite. So I'm going to go with 4 wins for South African teams.
Yes.
I'm going to go with the Stormers winning by 15.
Yes. Some more.
Yeah, they'll get the 5 league points. So the Stormers are that kind of team. They're not putting anyone away, and one doesn't need them to as long as there's 5 league points. I think the Lions are going to be a great game. You'll see the Dragons do more than just defend, but I've got them to win by 20. So I'm on par with you there. Krappies and the boys. And that midfield of Henker van Wyk and Bronson Mills. And Ruan Venter. Come on, I need a big game from you again, as does Rossi, as does Cash van Rooyen. And then I've got the Bulls to beat Munster by 16 points.
Sure, mate.
I just had to calculate in my head. 16 points. I've got them to win quite comfortably. Munster are under strength. The Bulls are playing some good rugby. They just need to sustain it. What I did like about them scoring those 33 points for halftime, they only scored 7 in the second half. against Carter, but they didn't concede any. So good defense there. And I've got the Sharks. I've got the Sharks to grind out a win and to win.
He's such a Sharks fan, eh?
I've got the Sharks to win by 15 on a Friday night.
Yes.
No ambushing there. I love because it. As JP said, it can't be one step forward and three back.
Yep.
They've now got to take a couple of steps forward. So I've got a 4 from 4 and a great way to finish round 14 of the URC and then go into the playoffs of the Investec Champions Cup for the Bulls and the Stormers. The Lions get a rest because they're not in the EPCR Challenge Cup playoffs. The Sharks go and play there. And then by the time we come back, two big rounds again in the URC, hopefully we've got teams that are still, they've got a team that's still in the semifinals for May. And who knows, maybe even in the final in the north of Spain at the end of May and then into that last run. So well positioned, but home games, non-negotiable. You've got to bank the 4, hopefully the 5 points, and like keep the pressure on a team like Leinster, who've never been 8 from 13 in this kind of competition, that they would then have to travel away, knock over Glasgow, and then come to Cape Town or Pretoria and lose in a playoff game. Let me check my crystal ball. That's all going well. And then Investec Champions Cup, mate. We've been calling it from the beginning. That's incredible first ever Champions Cup quarterfinal in Cape Town between the Bulls between the Bulls and the Stormers.
Let it be so.
It will be a sellout. It will be magnificent. Apologies for your ears. I get very excited when I think of the Stormers hosting the Bulls in the Investec Champions Cup in Cape Town in the quarterfinal. And it's just it'll be monumental. And I believe both teams have the capability to go win their respective last 16 matches. The Bulls will travel to Glasgow and the Stormers go to Toulon. And as Zals and I reminded you, Toulon, 9 from 19 in the top 14. We know it's not an easy league. They haven't been overly convincing. Their form has been patchy. The Stade Mayol not quite there when Johnny Wilkinson, Brian Abana and Joe Fanikak, John Smith and the like were there, and Bucky's Buerta. But we're going to speak quite exclusively about the Investec Champions Cup next week. But right now, as partisan and biased as I am towards South African teams, geez, it's hell of a hard to look past Bordeaux given what they did to Toulouse.
Exactly, mate. Going to Europe and having to face those teams there is a whole different kettle of fish. I think if it was a situation where they were having to travel here, definitely. But that's a tough ask. You don't just rock up there and roll those guys. So huge challenge.
And we spoke about the difference in the week earlier, the show earlier in the week. Bordeaux losing to Pau, 39-17, with effectively their second stringers. And then out of the Six Nations come all the guys. Toulouse pretty much picked their strongest team, except for Dupont, who they rested. Bordeaux picked their team. Damien Penno had a lot to kind of prove to himself and to everyone else. Luku was there. Jalibert was there. And they pumped Toulouse by 20 points. That's a massive win. That's the Bullstormers kind of rivalry, massive. Toulouse and Bordeaux at the moment. At one stage it was Toulouse and Toulon, but now it's Bordeaux. Bordeaux going for their second successive Investec Champions Cup win, primed and top placings in the top 14 with Toulouse. And those two teams, should they win their last 16, which they should, get to meet in the top 8. So one of the French giants will be going home. We're hopeful of chatting to Brian Abana next week.
Yeah.
And the relevance of chatting to Brian Abana, outside of him being the greatest finisher, the greatest winner who's played for South Africa in terms of his try scoring, 67 tries, a World Cup winner 2007, World Player of the Year 2007, a wonderful servant to the Bulls, fantastic for the Stormers in Cape Town, and just brilliant for Toulon. In his time there, and he and Bucky's Buerta was also at Toulon, the only guys, the fans primarily of Europe voted for their best ever Investec Champions Cup team over the 30 years history, and Brian Abana and Bucky's Buerta made it into that team, and that says everything about the impact. So if you think it's hard for him to lose in that playoff game because his mind could be on Toulon, it could be on the Stormers, it could be on the Bulls. I don't think he's got any Glasgow.
No.
He's not on the Glasgow wee. No. He's got to go wearing a ski kilt. Eh? Train spotting.
No.
A turban. Yeah. So hopefully we get to chat to him. And what we will chat about is basically the different cultural differences between Stormers, Bulls, and Toulon, and just mainly his time in Toulon, and trying to give people an understanding of the Stade Mayol and just what makes it so special there. Because we think in Pretoria, they got the best fans, and Captain got the best fans. You speak to Munster, you speak to the guys in Toulon, and they say a different level as well. Clermont the same. So Investec Champions Cup, it all starts next weekend and the weekend after that. So over the Easter, it's going to be full on the best teams in Europe. And fortunately, we've got two teams, the Stormers and the Bulls still in it, and the Sharks will be playing in the EPCR Challenge Cup, one that they won a couple of seasons ago. If you look at the All Blacks, he's finally made it. He's finally made his call, Zells, Dave Rennie. Not necessarily the most popular calls either. And it's been incredible for me how much white-brown conversation has come out of New Zealand at the moment. People talking about the brown element, the Pacific Islanders, the cultural thing, the need for Tanu Umaga to be in that side. It's just maybe, and I know people have thought it all their lives, but it's never been that publicly spoken about Pakeha, Maori, Polynesian. It's like you're a Kiwi, you're a New Zealander. And now there's this difference like, oh, there's going to be a Pacific Island heritage in the side. Tana Umaga, there's he's got to keep the Pacific Island boys comfortable with Dave Rennie, who's got Cook Islands is where his mom came from. But they've got a Scotsman in the mix, Mike Blair, former scrum half captain. Dave Rennie met him at Glasgow, and he's going to be his attack coach. He's with him in Japan at the moment, if he can get a work permit. But I'm fascinated by the rhetoric that's come out of New Zealand. Firstly, the Artie Sevier wasn't even a consideration for the captain, and now they don't want him in the starting 15. They actually say maybe off the bench. How has that guy's shares dropped since he shafted Razor?
Yeah.
He scalped the Razor. Cut him to pieces. Okay?
Blunted him.
What have you made of the appointments, and what have you made of kind of your first impressions of this coaching staff?
Well, I love that Dave Rennie has got his guys. You know, that's important. I think as a coach, the number one thing you've got to do is pick your assistants, because it's no good you're a great coach and you've got a great bunch of guys, but the lieutenants you're leaning on to actually execute the coaching and the planning are maybe not your first choice guys. So I think giving Rennie exactly what he wants is precisely what New Zealand needs to do. And that makes Rennie accountable for the results. So I rate Dave Rennie extremely highly. I think he is the best appointment they could have made. And he's worked with Mike, like you say, and knows how Mike operates and what his sort of philosophy is. And there's obviously a great mesh there. I think that is a good development. Tana Umaga is probably my favorite non-Springbok player of all time. I love Tana Umaga. I used to get up to watch the Canes just to see Tana play. So I love the guy. I'm not sure, coaching-wise, that his track record puts him in the best position to make the All Blacks successful. But you have to also understand that he's coached teams that haven't been great. It's not that he took great teams and made them not so good. The defense numbers around Mana Pacifica and the Blues were underwhelming. So he's going to have to buck that trend at the All Blacks level. Fortunately for him, he's going to have the best available talent at the All Blacks. I would say if you were going to highlight one guy in there for question marks, only because I don't really know Mike Blair very well. And who's the other guy? Neil Barnes, mate. You were telling me all about him. The Ian Mack of All Blacks rugby.
Okay, so interesting one. So no one would know him better than Beaver, Stephen Donald. And, you know, he does that lovely podcast, After Match. And I've just got some comments that he made, Kirsten Beeve. And he said he's the senior assistant title. It's an interesting one for Barnsley because he's a senior citizen. I'm sure he gets the cheap deals on that gold card. He well and truly qualifies. But for Barnsley, it's a great story, says Stephen Donald. He's coaching a level he's well and truly equipped to do. Yes, he's been coaching Taranaki, but that's just a passion of his. He's not somebody that's got to this job by being a political player, which is what a lot of guys do. To get to this level, they've got to have played the political game, not Barnsley. He is who he is. He's been who he is the whole time, and it's a wonderful appointment for the All Blacks. At his core, he's a hard, genuine Taranaki man. However, he's highly intelligent, highly positive rugby coach, and I don't think you can lose sight of his positivity towards the game. Now, for those who don't know, Barnsley, it's not Wayne Barnes, eh? Had a stint with Canada when Kieran Crowley was the coach of Canada, also coached Italy, and Kieran Crowley, a Taranaki legend. And Taranaki is where all the Barrett boys come out of, by the way. Okay. He's been with Italy. He was very decisive in changing mindsets there and mentality.
Okay.
And he's also been with Fiji. And Stephen Donald says he is the perfect foil for a guy like Jason Ryan, who's kept his job through Fozzie, through Scott Robinson, and now through Dave Rennie. So it tells you, and you've been a big Jason Ryan fan, that this guy's got something. But he says he often has a mentality that's Barnsley and uses words and phrases like, we'll score here or we'll use this play to score. And it's not about setting up another phase or relentless play. If he sees the opportunities through predominantly his forward work or his kickoff work, that's where they're going to go. Expect a very different type of All Black approach. And Rennie had said them in his appointment, I think I know the players to play the way I want to play, to beat the side well, like South Africa. And just watching their press conference, and it just felt like I was watching a leadership of the All Blacks from a throwback. Hard buggers, farmers. And they said to him, tough task. He said, it's tough getting up every morning, but he's in the shed at 6:30 cleaning with his workers. And then he goes to rugby. Farming is his first passion. And then Tana Umaga, as you said, coming in, just iconic captain.
Iconic, mate.
Wonderful player.
Yep.
And people who are critiquing him for not even necessarily had the success at the Blues. How successful was he with Mohana Pacifica? He is in there to provide the defensive coaching, but also to bring presence, to bring aura, to bring mana. I don't know how his role can be second-guessed, because it's very clear.
Mm.
He hasn't brought him in to be the head coach.
Mm. Yeah, well, look, I mean, the bottom line is the All Blacks can't leak points, and that's the defense coach's job. I think culturally great, but you've got to convert that into performance. So, obviously, rooting for Tana. Love Tana Umaga, but yeah, he's got his work cut out there for him, because the All Blacks are probably at the bottom or near the bottom in their sort of history of tradition of fantastic success. So I think every way is up. I think Dave Rennie's the man to make that change. I think Jason Ryan adds value. The fact that Rennie's vouched for Blair, Tana and Barnsley is a good sign. And the fact that he's got the freedom to kind of implement his vision, pick who he needs to play his vision, whether that's Artie Sevier, all 12 of the Barrett brothers, none of the Barrett brothers, it doesn't matter. The All Blacks need to bounce back. If you're a Kiwi fan, this is what you want. And for the state of world rugby, the box needs somebody that can push them a bit more consistently. So it'd be great to have the All Blacks back on the scene.
And if you also look at the one thing I've noticed, there's not panic. Huh? So they're staying in Japan, seeing out their season till the end of June. Forget that they play their first match against France in July. He says, I don't need to be in New Zealand to know who I'm going to pick,
yep,
how I want to play. So what you're not hearing is a four-year plan, a 18-month plan to the next World Cup. I've got to get out of my contract now. I've got to be there. He's so understated. He's got Barnsley in New Zealand, who knows the scene. Blair's staying with him at the moment. They're going to come over together. Tana's in the mix. Immediately, he's picked two guys who are very familiar. One's coaching in Super Rugby. The other one has been coaching at a domestic level and been very involved. And Barnes was with him when they won back-to-back Super Rugby titles. So I have put the box on red alert again since Dave Rennie's appointment. I think he's a hell of a good coach. He's right for them. I think it's going to be rugby's greatest rival. It's going to be an incredible test series here, the three tests, and then the one in the USA. It is feeling more and more like this is the rivalry, not Scott Robinson bringing his Crusaders are going to get rolled by Russie's Bulls.
Yeah.
So that kind of feeling.
But qualify that, because we are both very much on the Rennie train. We both believe that the All Blacks will bounce back. The question is, what is the timeline? Are we going to see these guys pushing the box in this greatest rivalry tour? Is it a year away, 2 years? Is it the World Cup? When do you expect Rennie's team to be firing?
I think you'll see an immediate type of mentality change, which is not necessarily going to be in a result here. And when I say a result, I would be shocked if they came and won the series here,
sure,
against the Springboks.
Same.
Okay. But where I was like 3-0, I don't know what's going to happen in the exhibition one in Baltimore.
Yeah.
It's like, it's leaning more and more towards they have the potential with that build-up to actually get a win. Where would that win be? And if we're going to win the series, we're going to fight to win that series. It's going to be similar to the 2021 Lions series, where it's going to come down to a score, it's going to come down to a kick. And that's what World Rugby wants. The two greatest rivals, 7 World Cups between them, incredible history, to kind of produce those games at Ellis Park, DHL Stadium in Cape Town, and then obviously 94,000 at the FNB Stadium. So that's going to be wonderful. That is coming in August. Zels and I will be at those three test matches, so look out for us, especially in FNB Stadium when I take
Baltimore.
Oh, well, Zell's will be in Baltimore, okay? I'm going to have to go there. I'm going to have to beam him in through. Scotty, are you there? I don't need more poor. But from Test Rugby, from URC, Investec Champions Cup, we go to what we love the most is schoolboy rugby. And it's that time of the year again. It's festival time. We get into the last week of March and then into the first week of April. It's school holidays. And at all the festivals, I love it for the most because I know Sachs normally win two or three games at a festival. and then the hardship kicks in when they come back post-holidays. They've got to go play Paul Boisard, Paul Ruiz, and Battle Chum.
Yep.
And then every now and again, you think the soft one is the farm, Bolan Lampo. And so forget that they've still got to play Weinberg, Rondebosch. I know Bishops is the easy one for them. But and I think hopefully they avoid Stellenberg, as I did say. But they've given them enough airtime. Let's talk about the real rugby schools at the moment that are out there, mate. And where do you see it going?
Mate, I see there's a lot of festivals. All the teams are in action, obviously. Some of them are evenly matched. I think there's some mismatches here, some high-profile schools playing some lesser schools. But just fantastic to be in a country where you've got this sort of level and this sort of quantity of high school rugby. Fantastic to see. We're all keeping our eyes on it to see where the next Marcus Miller, the next Riley Norton is going to come out of. So...
I can tell you that it's coming out of Paul Ruiz. What else do you want to know? Hey, and great college potential, Marcel Tinnison or Andre Juchaventa.
Yeah.
And then a Bronson Mills will come out of Cairns. What's coming out of Uffies at the moment?
I don't know, mate. No idea.
No idea. Okay, but if you look at it, is the big Pretoria Boys High 125th Rugby Festival.
Yep.
So shout out to them, 125 years. You know who went to Pretoria Boys High? John Smith and a guy called Elon Musk, okay? So
I heard of the first guy.
Yeah. Who's that second guy?
What did he play? Frank?
He's in charge of the Mars 15, I can tell you, though. Mars 23. And then, obviously, starting this weekend, this week, it's the latter part, it's the North Site. Tweed Ascent and Sessions won a North-South 2026. It's the Northern Schools against the Southern Schools. It moves around. Last season, we had it at Paul Ruiz. It was wonderful. Just incredible kind of turnout that they had there.
JP Paul Boys.
Yeah. Oof. We've got Paul Ruiz against Monument.
Monument, yeah.
Cairns against Otaniqua. Hartsfontein against Stellenberg. I've got Stellenberg to win that one. Hartsfontein, a good side. Who went to Hartsfontein? Ambrose Papira, many others. And we go down to Scene, great college, help McCarr, Uffies, Oakdale. Oakdale, a very good team as well. You know who went to Oakdale?
Who?
Paulie de Villiers.
There you go, mate.
Otaniqua, Marnie Lebok, Ari Kalant.
Look at that.
I think. Transvalia, Ari Kalant. Did you know that?
You're all over it, mate.
I know, right? Wismort. I don't know who went there. Wismort, okay. But then
who
you go down.
Who went to Hilton, mate?
Excuse me?
Who went to Hilton?
Bob Skinstead.
Yes, he did.
Also known as Bob. Pretoria Boys High against Paul Ruiz. That will be a good one. So one of the best teams in the country playing the host. And then Boys High also there. And if you go down
at the
Grey College of playing Stellenberg, Gary von Lochenberg will be. This is the game they've been waiting for. Grey College against Stellenberg. Uffies against Durnwell. Those Oaks from the area that I also grew up in the northern suburbs, it's just wonderful to see them on the map, challenging the big traditional schools in South Africa. So there'll be lots of schoolboy rugby. We will chat about that next week, give you our unexpected moments, the things that happened. But before we go, I got to ask you a question, mate. Who's the hardest bastard in world rugby? Who do you think?
Ever or today?
Who's the one you played in six touch?
Yeah, no. I mean, ever, you got to have Buckies in the conversation. For me, Dwayne Vermeulen is a no-brainer in the top three, if not first place there. Dwayne Vermeulen, we bumped into him in the airport on our way up to Pretoria, and I said to him, mate, any chance you got your boots with you, we could always use an extra shoulder or two. Dwayne Vermeulen is pretty peerless in my view. And then Skulk, 2004 Skulk, not linking Skulk at the end, Hammer Skulk, equally as difficult, I think, in the ferocious contact situation. For you?
Yeah, like Buckies, he's always up there, okay? I understand when Skulkberger isn't put in that thing because he's got such an incredible personality off the field. And I think because of the way he evolved his game.
Totally.
When he came back from that that life-threatening bacterial meningitis infection, lost 20 kilograms, was close to losing his life.
Yeah.
It was a very different Skulk that came, and the fact that he got onto a rugby field was a miracle. that he played for Province and the Stormers again, and that he went to a World Cup and played for the Springboks. That was remarkable.
Yep.
I mean, that was bigger probably than his 2004 debut season, where you saw the mop of hair, and you just, as Eddie O'Sullivan, the Irish coach, said at the time, the difference between Ireland losing and the Springboks winning was one guy. You may have seen his blonde mop all over the place. He was the player of the series that year, world player of the year. He was just phenomenal. But you don't associate him with a thug, with illegal or illegal, or just this guy's the enforcer. He's just a brilliant rugby player. For me, the matchup with him was always him and Jerry Collins having a run at each other. And as Skulk says, they would seek each other out from 60 meters. And if the play was that way, the play was that way, and he saw Jerry Collins, he would run that way just to basically take the contact. And he's known Jerry Collins from the kickoff. He's looking for him, and he's taking a 40-meter run back to him.
Worth the price of admission.
I remember Sean Fitzpatrick saying to Big Skulk, 2007, that made an incredible comeback, the All Blacks, to win 26-21. But Skulk and Little Skulk and Jerry Collins had just gone for each other all match. Also on Fitzpatrick to get those hands. Have you ever seen two Warriors go like that?
Yeah.
So when I look at lists, what surprises me is that Jerry Collins isn't there in a lot of lists. And again, maybe because he went overseas, the late Jerry Collins, he played a bit of club rugby. So it's kind of out of sight, out of mind.
Mm.
But Colsey and Ben Youns, they do For the Love of Rugby. I mean, it's a great podcast, great banter. And then they pick their top 10 and 4 South Africans and a Namibian in the top 10. That's quite
there. You go, mate.
That's kudos.
There you go.
For the southern part of Africa. And your man, Dwayne, is in. He's at number 5. But they said between 8 and 5, take your pick. And they went Dwayne Vermeulen, Teddy Dusatoir, France, Jasper Visser, Eben Etzebeth. And they played with Jasper at Leicester. And they just said, the guy's a machine. Great guy off the field for a beer. Wonderful team man. But he is just, they call it triple bastard hard. It is just so hard and can do it. I mean, Jasper, wow.
Yeah, I think, so that list is the guys they've played with before. I mean, obviously.
Or against.
Or against. So you and I could think of, like you say, Jerry Collins. Brad Thorne was a hard man in his day. You know, there's Sione Loaki was a freaking monster. So there are other guys to think of. Those are the blokes that they played with. I'm surprised Courtney Laws is as low on that list as they've got him.
No, and they said the top 8 was so big and so strong and so hard. They had to get Courtney Laws and Julian White, two of their mates from Leicester, one from Leicester, one from England, into the mix. And they said when it came to number 3, Jock Berger from Namibia, over 150 games for Saracens. They said, you just have to look at his face to know where he put it. It's flat as a pancake. And then, obviously, the big two, Henry Tuilagi, Papillon, Samoa, and his son now plays for France, bigger than his dad, of the famed Tuilagi family, and then Buck, his bird. So they said, even there, a league of his own. But an interesting thing, they were asked, would he make it in the modern game? And both Coles and Ben Young were like, you bet you would make it. That guy hardly got it. Don't think he got a red card. They said everything he may have done illegally, he did legally as well. So a shout out to Buckies. Okay?
Oh, mate.
Buckies is the
one of one.
The original enforcer. We love Buckies. He's a bull, hardened bull. And the only thing that I've always said that's bigger than Buckies' words in the world is his prize bull called Yellowstone. I mean, it's a magnificent looking bull. So I like that list, and I like that 5 Southern African guys are in there. And Jacques Berg, I mean, he's a guy that if he didn't play for Namibia, he probably would have played for South Africa in his time.
Yeah.
A great servant.
Yeah.
We're going to wrap it up, Zalzi, by just a reminder of Saturday night's kickoff at the DHL Stadium in Cape Town. It's the Stormers against Edinburgh. And I did a little stats comparison. Why the Stormers have made Cape Town South Africa's rugby capital.
Yes.
And the stats you just can't lie with. And people talk about Newlands, DHL Stadium. I mean, it's a very different vibe, but it's a very different crowd now.
Mm,
but the stats are very similar.
Continue.
33,000 on average over 157 games, Silver Super Rugby, Newlands.
Sure.
43,586, 24 tests between 96, the professional era, and 2019. And then you go to the Stormers era here. 27,733 in the 34 home matches played in the URC, including the 3 playoffs. And remember, COVID restricted those playoffs as well. Top crowd was at 33,000. And what I love is the Investec Champions Cup, 21,649 average crowd in those 8 games played over December and January. And what Super Rugby has, you started in basically late Feb and you went in and it was rugby season. They're competing with Test Cricket, with SA20. They're competing with so much in the summer.
Wow.
To get that. And then the test matches. They've had 3 test matches here. Wales, 51,347. New Zealand, 58,417. Australia, 56,350. And the Barbarians, 45,000. Incredible support from Cape Townians for the Stormers and also for the Springboks. It is, with no disrespect to Pretoria, Durban, or Johannesburg.
No, look, 100%.
Anywhere else.
Totally.
Nelspruit, Nelson Mandela Stadium, Bloemfontein. Cape Town is the best city in the world, but also the best supported rugby city and province in the world.
Yeah. Yeah, well, so my view is, obviously, they called it Newland Stadium. For me, the DHL Stadium should be called Rugby Town. This is a rugby-mad part of the world, maybe the most rugby-mad part of the world. And the attendance figures just back that up. People in the Western Cape and in Cape Town understand their rugby and support it vociferously. They want to be here. They want to be involved. They love their team. So it's fantastic.
All right. It's at 7 o'clock kickoff. Get there. I know a lot of people will be there, not necessarily just for the rugby, because there's the kicker. While Newlands delivered its biggest crowds in the traditional rugby windows to the traditional rugby people, I feel a bit like Jerry Springer, but I'm not reading it, okay? The Stormers, in the past 5 years, they've done it through peak holidays, which shows the enormous shift in audience behavior.